Welcome to The Connection. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. Today, something different. Earlier this week, I interviewed NPR Scott Simon for an event taped before an audience of WHYY members here at the station. So today on The Connection, we present highlights from that conversation. I am so pleased to be sharing the stage with Scott Simon, one of the most recognized, recognizable, and admired voices in public radio. When you listen to his interviews, you hear his warmth, you hear his empathy, his boundless curiosity, his gentle and probing questions, and his gift for storytelling. You also hear his explosions of laughter, which are very contagious. I know. We feel that we know him because he's told us about his family, which he wrote about in Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, and Unforgettable, A Son, A Mother, and the Lessons of a Lifetime. We know about his love for his hometown Chicago and some baseball team out there, with his books, My Cubs, A Love Story, and Home and Away, Memoir of a Fan. We know Scott because he began working at NPR almost 50 years ago, starting in 1977, do I have that right, I think, as Chicago Bureau Chief. He then
it was a sixth grade project.
Something like that. Yeah, you started very young, clearly. He then became host of Weekend Edition Saturday when it debuted in 1985, and he's one of the hosts of the NPR podcast Up First. There's more. Scott has reported from all over the country and all over the world, covering 10 wars and conflicts, including in El Salvador, Sarajevo, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He's won many of the most prestigious awards in journalism, and I'll name just a few, a Peabody, an Emmy, Columbia DuPont, Ohio State, Robert F. Kennedy, Presidential and Hunger Award, and the Studs Terkel Award. This is a good time to discuss Scott's career and the state of journalism in light of the current challenges and stresses of our political system and the changes in news gathering and news consumption. So let's give Scott Simon a big Philadelphia welcome, the way we cheer the Phillies.
Hey. Philadelphia fans get a bad
rap. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we do. But we sort of enjoy it. Yeah. I talked to a number of people tonight, and so many of them mentioned your voice. And I wonder, when you listened to the very early Scott Simon interviews or reports that you did, would we hear the same voice, or is this a different voice that you have today?
I have no idea. I don't listen to that.
You don't listen to yourself?
No. I don't listen to anything I do. I mean, my daughters don't listen to me. Why should I?
You don't listen either out of curiosity or
self-criticism? No, I don't. I mean, sometimes when we're, editing a piece and we have to get something, notably when we, a number of years ago, interviewed Bill Cosby and had to bring up the questions with him. I remember hearing that over and over again because we were trying to decide how we were going to play that, and we wound up playing it as it was. There was no edit whatsoever in that. And so I heard my voice then. But right. I give it, and I think, people come up to me, and for one reason or another, it happens a lot, and they say, oh, I like your voice.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm very pleased to hear that. But you know what? I don't have a great voice. Corva Coleman has a great voice. Robert Siegel had a great voice. Susan Stamberg had a great voice. Nina Totenberg has a great voice. I mean, I could go
on
and on.
What's a great voice?
I think a voice that communicates, a voice that has a kind of signature quality to it. I don't. I think what they mean is... No.
I think there's some disagreement out here.
Boy, maybe it's true what they say about Philly fans. I can't... Thank gosh.
Welcome
to
Philly.
Too warm to throw a snowball. But in any event... They are being nice, but I think they just mean it's familiar to them, and it brings up nice association.
Well, you mentioned Bill Cosby, and we did grab just a small portion of the interview that you did with him This was back in 2014, and he and his wife had, I guess, loaned some of their art to the National Museum of African Art, and it was also at a time when he had been accused of sexual assault. So let's just hear a very short clip with some significant silences as Scott Simon is talking to Bill Cosby.
This question gives me no pleasure, Mr. Cosby, but there have been serious allegations raised about you in recent days. You're shaking your head no. I'm in the news business. I have to ask the question. Do you have any response to those charges? Shaking your head no. There are people who love you who might like to hear from you about this. I want to give you the chance. All right. Camille and Bill Cosby.
Scott Simon goes from there. It is such a powerful silence. And you are so gracious and generous when you say, you know, there are people that love you that want to hear something. Was such an opening. Obviously, he didn't want to take it.
Boy. You know, I know we had to pursue. I could go on endlessly about this. I knew we had to pursue, obviously, that line of questioning.
Right.
And we did something we don't usually do. We kind of game planned it in advance. Well, what if he says this? What if he says that? What if he says, well, you know, no legal charges? Because at that particular point, there were allegations, but obviously legal charges, believe you me, followed soon thereafter. Mm-hmm. But in any event, none of that happened. He somehow decided that if he was silent, somehow we wouldn't use it. So, I mean, I will never forget. He gave what I would call, you know, the kind of smile he used to have on the Jell-O pudding pop commercials.
Yeah, yeah.
And just went like that.
Oh.
And yeah, because people, including me, loved him over the years. And these were serious, grievous charges, and they needed to be brought to his attention. And so when he wouldn't talk about them, that was obviously the time to end the interview. And there's something I want to tell since we're talking about public radio.
Sure.
The president of NPR then was a man named Jarl Mohn. And I knew Mr. Mohn. We'd say hello. I mean, you know, we president of the network, you don't really have a lot to do with them. It was all very cordial. And I forget what day of the week. It was early in the week we recorded that. And toward the end of the week, somebody on our staff who'd been involved in the production got a phone call from Bill Cosby. Huh. And I won't attempt to do a bad Bill Cosby imitation, but he said, you know, I know Mr. Simon and his reputation in broadcasting, and he doesn't go in for filth, he doesn't go in for sleaze, and I know that he wouldn't have anything to do with, you know, filth and sleaze. And, you know, Mrs. Cosby and I mean, you saw it in the art collection, we have an extensive fortune. And we often ask at this point in our lives where we might apply this fortune, where it could be. So the young producer came to me and said, she said, what should I do? And I said, nothing, absolutely nothing. Picked up the phone, called Jarl Mohn's office, and within 5 minutes was up there.
Yeah.
And I told him the story, and I said, I'm telling you this for two reasons. One is you were the president of the network, and you obviously, this should be brought to your attention. But secondly, I'm not telling you because I want you to do something. In fact, I'm telling you because I don't want you to do anything.
Right.
And God bless him, Jarl Mohn said to me, forgive me, do your fucking job.
Well, there you go.
Didn't hesitate, didn't say, oh, let me handle this, let me talk to the development people. Said, do your, forgive me, effing job. I don't know how you're going
to
handle it.
We will find some little blip to put in there. But but one thing that just, and I've listened to it several times, there's something about silence on the radio.
Yeah.
That you lean in, your ears prick up, you want to fill it somehow, but it's so powerful and so poignant.
Yes, and it was always it was also important to me when we discussed different ways of presenting it that, that no edits be made in it because I didn't want people to think we had done anything to edit that
right.
you know and
right.
and I'm you know I'm glad we didn't do that.
That was Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday and one of the hosts of NPR's Up First. We spoke on Tuesday night in front of a live studio audience at WHYY about his long career in journalism, his family, and some of the highlights from his career, including some memorable interviews. Coming up, Scott Simon and Dame Edna get flirty with each other. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Today we're listening back to an interview I recorded earlier this week with NPR Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday. When we left off, we learned about his tense interview with Bill Cosby. And now for something and someone completely different. This is from 2003. It's your interview with Dame Edna. A character created by Barry Humphries, who was on a U.S. tour. That's, I think.
On a U.S. tour.
Yes, and wanted to be interviewed in character.
Do you know why he wanted to be interviewed?
No, I don't think I do know why.
Should I?
Well, you know what? Let's listen.
Let's listen,
and then we can fill in. But this is basically how the interview starts.
I must say, without putting you on the spot, I think you look especially lovely this morning.
Oh, lovely, Scott, and I knew you thought I looked lovely by that little squeeze you gave my leg under this desk.
I don't do that with every guest.
You
I want
don't,
to
and
know.
It's a lovely studio. You didn't inappropriately touch me, which is the main thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is the main this day and age, right?
In the old days, it was called flirtation, and it was legitimate.
I'm just guessing you probably run into that a lot, Dame Edna, don't you?
Well, I do. I'm no beauty, and I'm not a sex pot or a glamour puss, but I am an attractive, mature woman with a very interesting, husky little voice this morning, too. Might be a turn-on for some people.
Oh, I think among our listeners, our viewers, if you please, I think that's very much the case.
I mean, I love that, and the fact that you're flirting with Dame Edna is delicious.
Well, I thought Dame Edna, the late Barry Humphries, it is now, is utterly hilarious.
Yeah.
And I was also interested in speaking with him about his long theatrical career, from Australia, went to London, mm-hmm. hit on the West End. He was in the original. He was the original Artful Dodger in
really?
In Oliver,
oh,
which
wow.
I'll simply say I played myself at the age of 12 to somewhat.
Well, can I say I was also the Artful Dodger in high school?
Really?
I was.
Consider yourself well off. Consider yourself part of the furniture. Yeah, sure.
Anywho, go ahead.
All right, so, and I wanted to talk to him about all that, and then we got a call from a publicist of the kind you would usually ignore,
yeah.
who explained that he had a death near to him. In the family. And he said, the publisher said, look, he's still going to do the tour. It's important for him to get out there and work, but he doesn't want to talk about his life. He wants to be Dame Edna.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, under the circumstances, right. you know, of course. So I interviewed Dame Edna with no break from from that, and it was utterly hilarious. One of my favorite. And we became friendly thereafter. It was very
well, you nice. Apparently, later on in the interview, laughed so hard you literally fell out of your chair.
I did. She said something so totally outrageous
yeah.
that we can't put on the air anymore, but I fell out of my chair
yeah.
laughing.
Yeah. I think I heard some of that.
Yeah.
It's funny about laughter because I also feel like you're a crier.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I am a crier. I get kidded about how much I cry. I don't think of myself as being weepy, but it doesn't take much to set me off, and particularly when it comes to my children.
Oh, right. Children will do that.
I cry about our daughters all the time. So it's not as if
it's emotion. It's the welling of emotion.
Yeah, it's the welling of emotion. And look, I mean, I hope I'm professional. I try and do my job. I have interviewed plenty of people who have suffered terrible, you know, losses. That's the job. And I like to think that I can be empathetic and draw them out and listen to what they have to say, what they want to say in some ways, without being a basket case myself. I mean, they're the ones who are entitled to cry, not me. But every now and then it absolutely breaks through. But I remember in the days following 9/11, interviewing the father of a New York City fireman who had died, and he had a son who worked for a brokerage industry who was in the tower number 2 who died, and he had a son who was a fireman who died.
Wow. How can you not cry?
I was, and I don't want to say he was fine because he wasn't fine, but he was very troubled, and it reflected in his eyes. But I was the one who you could hear, you know, the catch in the, and that, you know, and that's happened a number of times over the years. I can't fight it, I every now and then I put up a good show.
Let me just shift gears a little bit, because we're told more and more that the public is sick of news. In fact, some say for your own mental health, you should take a news break. Does that inform what you do on Saturday, thinking that you've got to somehow keep people pulled in but not destroy their mental health?
Let me give the original yes and no answer.
Okay.
Because I think the question of mental health is something I'm not prepared to answer. We do not duck any legitimate news story. But I think we try and leaven the show, those weeks that we can, with feature interviews with musicians, with artists, with actors, with comedians, with novelists, with people who in fact can, not always joyful, but people who can talk about other areas of life and with joy. You know, the joy of work well done, that's certainly with music. And I think that's important because, as I've sometimes said, we could put 2 hours on the air every week of hitting people over the head with important stories, and no one would listen. Or there'd be a small coterie of people who would listen who'd like to be hit over the head. We get the audience that we do, which, interestingly, according to the latest figures, is even growing. We get the audience that we do because it is a mixture. And I think that's part of, if you're going to have a relationship with an audience, which I think is what we're trying to do, it has to have all different features of a relationship. You can sometimes do two obituaries in a row, but it probably shouldn't be three. You can do two funny pieces in a row, but it probably shouldn't be. And same thing with serious and grave issues. And I think that's all part of keeping a relationship up, because if you're always hitting people over the head, you'll be dismissed as a common scold. And if you're always trying to, at least in news, trying to entertain them, you'll be dismissed as a clown. Now, my father was a clown.
Yeah.
I happen to respect clowns, but that's not, you know.
Yeah.
Some people would argue. I would tell you that's not the business I'm in. Some people would disagree. But in any event, and I think that's all part of having a relationship with an audience where you have all facets of something.
Do you get hate mail?
Sure, yeah. Nowadays it's social media.
Right.
I don't remember the last time I got a hateful
letter
envelope.
With a stamp.
Oh, social media, terrible stuff. And anti-Semitic stuff.
What do you do about that?
Real hate mail, I make no response.
Right.
As an interracial adoptive family, and people know about that, I get a significant amount of people to think there's something wrong with that. And it's interesting, Marty, I must say, it's not necessarily from people you think who object to transracial adoptions and interracial families. There are people who are against interracial adoptions because they feel that we have deprived our children of their heritage.
Wow.
I just think anybody who doesn't think our children are delightful, I have no use for. But other than that, I just dismiss that. What I like getting, and I think this is good, I get social media posts from people who don't like certain things they hear or certain things they think they've heard or certain things they've heard that I have had no role in, but they've been on NPR, sometimes not even an NPR show, but they complain to me about it. And I'm glad they do. I'm glad that they're listening. I sometimes want to say, well, if you're going to register a few complaints, why don't you make a contribution? Because obviously this is giving you, some enjoyment in life, so why not keep it going? But I think that's good. I think we should have a certain part of the audience that's like that. And I welcome that. I think that's wonderful.
You do share parts of your life, your daughters. You wrote the book about adopting them. You wrote a book about your mother. So you are very revealing air. And is there a point where you don't want people to go? I'm sure there is. But do you sort of wrestle with how much to say about you?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, I accept the fact that by opening up our family life, interracial adoptive family, that I can, if people want to criticize it, they can. I think on that basis, I think it's little peculiar, let's put it that way.
I don't
appreciate that. Interestingly, I had more people mention my mother to me on the air than I mentioned her myself. I was not on the air when my mother took sick, but I was with my mother in the ICU for that what turned out to be, I think, about the last 9 days of her life. And I was tweeting about
you
it.
You were. Yeah.
And that got, I think it's safe to say, a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Social media was a little newer in those days. And also, my mother was hugely entertaining.
Yeah, she sounded hugely entertaining.
My mother was an old showgirl, and I will never forget, among so many other things, she just, when it was clear to both of us that she was going to be leaving us soon, she said, "I don't know why this is taking so long. I guess I'm just late for everything." I mean, she was utterly hilarious, and my mother knew what I did for a living.
Yeah. There's a tweet that you said, which I wanted to read because I thought it was so lovely. And you tweeted, "I love holding my mother's hand. Haven't held it like this since I was 9. Why did I stop? I thought it unmanly. What crap?"
Yeah, I remember
lovely.
That now.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
People don't often talk about death.
I thought that there were some things to share that might mean something to people.
Well, I think it did.
Yes, I think it. I think it did, and I'm glad to say it did. And it's still. I mean, it's happened here today. Talking to people, it happens all the time. People come up to me and say that meant something to them, and then they tell me their own story.
Yeah.
And I'm glad for that.
You have been a journalist since the 1970s.
Yeah.
And I counted up, I think that's 9 or 10 different presidential administrations, from Jimmy Carter to Donald.
I can't count that high.
I did it twice. Yeah. Make sure. Do you feel like today you're still guided by the same rules and regulations of journalism back in the olden days that you have to follow today? Or have things changed?
Well, I mean, early in my career, I obviously had nothing to do with presidents.
Right.
I mean, I am proudly a Chicago journalist, an old Chicago journalist. And as I have sometimes said to people, that's with due regard to public television, we are the profession of the front page, the great Hecton MacArthur play set in the criminal courts building of Chicago. We are the profession of the front page and not Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. We're supposed to be irreverent. We're supposed to ask contrary questions. That doesn't mean we're without, human sympathy and human empathy. But I think there is a natural skepticism of power which we're supposed to exercise. And that's part of what we do. And, it's not just a skepticism of power. It's, I think, a skepticism of any idea that's floated or any power structure. It doesn't have to be you know, it doesn't have to be government. I think it's important for our audience to ask themselves questions and to be surprised and to be introduced to dissonant attitudes and be able to, you know, something. I don't think we should say to our audience, and there are news organizations, or if they are news organizations that do this, pat our audience on the head and say, yes, you're right. You're right about everything. And we're going to give you information and bring you viewpoints that absolutely ratify your viewpoint. Don't you worry, you won't hear anything contrary here. I don't think that's what an honest and effective news organization does. And that's not what we do.
How do you deal with dissent? How do you deal with disinformation, misinformation, even conspiracy theories that seem to have sort of embedded themselves in the news to the point where I think sometimes it's hard to tell, was this real? Did it really happen? And now with AI, of course, sometimes it's difficult to tell if what you're looking at is really
That's just increasing, and we have to be careful, you know, to certify. I do worry about how many people find themselves so easily falling into certain reservoirs of belief that way, and will absolutely hear nothing else from us other than what they're absolutely certain has happened.
Right.
And I worry about that, because the whole idea of a democracy is for people to make what we hope are informed decisions. People are free to make any kind of decision they want, but if it's based on misinformation and myth and allegory and bigotry and suspicion, then obviously the results are going to be, let's just say, discouraging.
Indeed. Do you see President Trump as a threat to journalists and journalism?
I must say I don't feel the threat personally. Mm-hmm. I don't think he listens to NPR. Or at least me.
Well, he helped to defund.
Oh, I know.
The corporation.
I know. He did, but that's not a new idea. I mean, that's been gathering strength, and I do think we have to have strength for years. Also, do you have your iPhone on you?
No.
Well, here's my point. I'm going to be metaphorical. You can get news from all over the world from millions of people by holding that in your hand. I don't think it's entirely wrong for people to say to public broadcasting, what do you do that no one else does when look how easily I can get news? Now, we have answers for that, but I don't think somebody who asked the question is necessarily to be distrusted. When I say that I don't think he listens to us, I say that with some regret, because I wish we had demonstrably more people who, I guess, have supported him at one time or another but I personally don't feel threatened, but you know, that could change. I don't think it's healthy, let's put it that way, when he takes out after individual journalists. I mean the thing is, he's not kidding. I traveled for a few days years ago in one of John McCain's presidential campaigns. And he would take journalists in like a bear hug and go, "You communists, I can't believe you said," but that was like all in good fun. And that was, this is not in good fun. But, I'm also old enough to remember that in our history, there have been journalists who have, like my mentor in many ways, the late Dan Shore, he was on the enemy's list, subject of an IRS audit. I think there have been individual journalists who, for one reason or another, have been, marked for criminal investigation unfairly. Yet, on the other hand, I try and keep a sense of proportion on it. You know, if I was in Russia, I would have to stay away from windows.
Yeah.
Did you notice just today or just yesterday, the former publisher of Pravda? Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Pushed from a window again. Well, I shouldn't say that. God bless him. But in any event. So I try and keep a sense of proportion about it. But, and look, I don't want to say on the one hand this, on the other hand that. I do think the two previous Democratic administrations, they didn't have enemies lists, But there were investigations, when James Rosen broke stories about the national security apparatus, he was, he was
under Obama,
targeted for investigation
right?
under Obama. Yeah.
I'm curious, and I do want to move on from this, but as someone who loves Chicago, but when you see National Guards people on the street or, a helicopter dropping soldiers, for lack of a better word, on an apartment building and dragging people, including children, outside. Is that personal to you?
Yeah, of course it does. Absolutely. We're going to be going back, my family and I, twice in the next couple of weeks for various events. And there's soldiers, National Guardsmen, walking up and down North Michigan Avenue.
Yeah.
Now, a few years ago, a producer named Peter Breslow and I did a story on right off the corner of West 63rd Street, where there was a family, and when their children came home about 3:45 every day, they battened down the hatches of their apartment building on West 63rd. They literally had doors that they put up in their windows. Because there were shooting incidents at night, usually between rival gangs. That's not where they're sending the National Guard.
No.
They're sending them to get their pictures taken on the North Michigan Avenue Bridge, which is, by the way, where I proposed to my wife. they're keeping that. What makes me uneasy about it is I think everybody is performing more than anything else. The deployment for the moment has been a little bit foreclosed by a court order. We'll see what happens. It tears me up to think about that.
I keep thinking, I've seen several times this short video of a priest, a Chicago priest, who gets shot with a rubber bullet of some sort. It wasn't a real bullet, but nonetheless, he falls to the ground.
Yeah, that's real enough.
He's got
his
collar on.
Yeah, exactly. It's an ugly time. What can I say? It's an ugly time.
That's Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. I interviewed him on Tuesday night for a member event at WHYY. We are presenting portions of that conversation today on The Connection. Coming up, Scott gets emotional, remembering people he met while covering war. Stay with us. Scott Simon has been affiliated with NPR since the 1970s, beginning as Chicago bureau chief. He was named the first host of Weekend Edition Saturday in 1985 when the program made its debut. He has won numerous awards for his humane style of journalism and storytelling. He's reported from all over the country and all over the world, including covering wars in El Salvador, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, and Sarajevo.
I do want to talk to you about the wars that you have covered, not the wars themselves, and you've covered something like 10 wars, but just what it is like. I mean, you're a feeling person, it's obvious, but what it's like to see that level of danger and suffering and what you do with that, or maybe how you work that into the stories that you've told.
I think ultimately, one way or another, you work it into the stories that you try to tell. But I think my answer would be incomplete if I didn't say that sometimes you are very inspired, too. Mm. I remember covering the Civil War, Ethiopia, Eritrea. And as I think people have been kidding about, I drink a lot of coffee.
Yes, I heard that.
Ethiopia, by the way, is arguably the home of coffee. In any event, but we were obviously staying in refugee camps or staying in trenches with army units, and there wouldn't always go. But we're in a refugee camp, and I smelled espresso, and then I heard the.
Oh yeah,
and I thought, this is it. It's my mind is playing tricks on me. This is a fantasizing that there's an espresso maker, But it turned out that there was a refugee family from Eritrea, and in fact, they were making espresso. And what I will never forget, they invited us to join them.
Aww.
The entire relationship changed.
Yeah.
They weren't refugees anymore. They were hosts. They were welcoming us to their circle. They were making me espresso. We were kidding. We were laughing. It I will never forget that. And it you know, reminded me the people we were covering weren't just statistics or people we talked about getting chased this way and that way. They were, you know, they were human beings who had their lives. And I felt that particularly. I felt it particularly strongly in Sarajevo, and I think people in Philadelphia would also feel this way about, because Sarajevo was a vibrant city with its own sense of humor, loved sports, sipping espresso in cafes, and the world was turning away from them. And I remember those years, and I think it's important for us to remember in the United States when we think of something like Ukraine at the moment. People were saying, oh, yes, it's terrible, but those people that don't have any vowels in their names, they've been fighting each other for centuries. What are we supposed to do about it? Or they were saying, yes, it's terrible, but what can we possibly do about it? And it was the people of Sarajevo, who mostly, by the way, were of mixed ethnic because they'd been intermarrying for, you know, decades and centuries at that particular point. It was the people of Sarajevo who rolled up their sleeves and saved themselves.
Wow.
And get three times they turned down an American, an internationally brokered offer for peace, because the offer was that they would divide themselves by ethnic divisions, and they said, no, we have not come this far in history to divide ourselves that way. And there are people who died because of that. But I was never more impressed by people who did that. And I think that's something that we in America should be impressed by. These were people who held up the values of civilization at a time the world was looking away.
Thank you for your...
Sorry.
No. Thank you.
Oh.
I'm always...
I carry one of these.
No. Right. I thank you for your emotions and the honesty of your feelings and talking about something that clearly matters and cares, is so caring for you, and it allows us to kind of feel what you're feeling, because, you know, I've never covered a war. I've never, I work in a studio and I talk to people, but to be out and to see, I guess, the worst of humanity, but also maybe the best of seeing people
rising to the
occasion.
It's the best that keeps you going.
Yeah. Are you still a Quaker? Are you a Quaker?
I'm multi-religious at this point.
Okay. How many?
Quaker, Catholicism, and Judaism.
Oh, wow.
My father was Jewish, my mother Catholic. I became a Quaker. I reassessed some of that, loving the Society of Friends, over Bosnia, as a matter of fact, because I did not see... I wrote about this, by the way, for the Quaker magazine Friends Journal. I didn't see a pacifist solution to the war in Bosnia, because as I said in the pages of Friends Journal, and not just the pages of Friends Journal, even when the Muslims in Srebrenica surrendered, they were slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to. And I, as I said to our daughters, you know, your religious faith is whatever you want it to be or not. It has been important to us for our daughters to grow up with exposure to religion and participate in religious ceremonies, and we do with them over several different faiths. But I've said to them, I mean, I won't embarrass them, but one of our daughters we call Little Christopher Hitchens,
the atheist, I guess.
An atheist and a very good friend of ours,
as a
matter of fact. Well, and it's funny, because I used to say to Christopher, I can grant what you say logically.
Yeah.
But I said, look, Christopher, we've both been around the world. I have seen nuns around the world trying to help and doing their best for people. I have seen priests go into communities nobody else wants to go to try and help the community. And, you know, I don't see Richard Dawkins doing that. And I say this with respect for Richard Dawkins. I think life has to be more about being intellectually accomplished. I think there's something to be said for the energy and the sense of resolution that religion can put into a life. As we've said to our daughters, life is not just about getting the best test score or winning the race. It's about human life. It's about the values of human life. It should be your experience and your friendship and your relationships with others. And you don't have to believe in God or have any religious sense to do that. But, you know, we find this a way of kind of setting a fuse into that process.
Yeah.
So who knows where they will wind up.
We're going to take questions from the audience in just a couple of minutes. I'm going from God to reading that you don't have a driver's license. Is that true?
And I think that's God's will in life.
You're sparing us from your
I do not have a driver's license, and I think the world is a safer place because of it.
Truly? Is that why?
You know what, Mari, if I might point out, Lincoln?
Yeah?
No driver's license.
Well, that is true. That is true.
Julius Caesar?
No.
I won't tell. I never had a car, in either my mother or my father. Number of years ago, my mother obviously still with us, my mother had remarried to a man who had a bookstore in central Illinois, had to drive down there every now and then, and he was falling asleep at the wheel. So she said, why don't we take driver's lessons at the same time? Make a long story short, a driving instructor named Gary, and after three or four lessons, I got a call from him. He was in the hospital. He'd had a whiplash with another student, I think we say. And he said, look, the school is going to call you and ask you to finish out your lessons with another driver, but that's money out of my pocket. Could you wait until... And I said, sure, Gary. I got a call from the school, and I said, well, if it's all right with you, I'd like to wait until Gary is back. And they said, oh, you didn't hear. Gary had died.
Oh, no.
And I thought, I said to my mother, what more has to happen for me to realize that I am
not getting a driver.
I'm getting a driver's license, yeah. So our oldest daughter has a driver's license, and even with the money she's been making out of college and on her first job, she
no car?
Even bought her own car.
Oh, wow.
I forget
driving
what it is.
Science.
Yeah, so but in any I'm very proud, and she and she drives us, and my wife drives.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, it's good to be driven.
Yeah.
Yes. Any hands? Of course you have questions. Yes.
First of all, thank you for being a national treasure. We love hearing you every Saturday.
Thank you.
And because you are such a sage, my question is, what's the advice you're giving to your daughters in these turbulent days?
I just want them to be happy. You know, I just want them to be happy. I mean, every now and then I say something that's a little more sonorous than that, and they go, so I try not to. But you know, the biggest lesson I ever got, verbal lesson I think I got about being a parent, was from my old summer camp friend Stewie Cohn, who told me a few years ago, he said, the one thing I've discovered about being a parent is you can talk yourself blue in the face. It doesn't matter. The only thing that counts is your example.
Mm.
I think that's true.
Yeah. Yes, a question over here. Yes, sir.
Love your essays and your interviews. In fact, I keep one of your essays on my phone. I'm curious, though, you mentioned the Bill Cosby interview. Are there any interviews that you regret having done, or questions you regret either having asked or not having asked?
Wow. I mean, I'm sure if I went into a deep investigation of it, I could, you know, I could come up with something, but nothing offhand, nothing occurs to me at the moment. I mean, you know, I interviewed Woody Allen years ago, but that was, I had...
You regret that?
No. I mean, it was a good movie, and, you know, he had a celebrated career as a filmmaker. I obviously knew about his marriage to the young woman who had entered his life, but at that point, other questions about his conduct hadn't been publicized at that point, so... maybe that, but I didn't know about that at the moment. He just wrote a very nice essay remembering Diane Keaton as a matter of fact.
Lovely.
So I'd have to think about that. I'm sure, but I conveniently forget my mistakes.
And a question over here.
As a journalist, is... is there any way, in your opinion, to close the gap on a nation that now looks at two completely different sets of facts?
Well, I honestly hope and believe that I hope the work we're doing can do some of that, even if it's people who listen to us to get upset. I like to think if they're that devoted, at some point something bursts through that makes them think, and vice versa. I really hope so. I hope that people who don't like NPR but listen, sometimes just to get angry, they can do that just for a week or two. I think something keeps them coming back. And as I've said to people on our staff over the years, the news is such that something happens. Unfortunately, it's often a tragedy. But something happens and we go into live coverage and people everywhere are finding it and listening to it, and then we, some people stay. And I like to think that the work we're doing can contribute something to that. But it takes work. There are lots of people that we would like to interview. I think, during the shutdown, for example, on a certain side of the aisle, that just don't want to be on NPR.
Mm.
And that's a choice that they are free to make, and it's all the more reason why our questions to people on the side of the aisle that does want to appear become sharper and more incisive, because we have to ask those questions. But look, what I despair about now is that people can, if they want to, they can find any kind of news they want, and for a lot of people. And I include sometimes our daughters. News is a DIY process. A lot of our daughters' friends they don't follow the news. It's something else. Now, I like to think that I don't mind the news skewing old. I think they will grow into the news. I think a lot of them will have to search for more information, and I like to think ultimately find us. But, we have to be ready for that. But the only thing that we can do at the moment is the best job that we can. And look, there are over 43 million people a week who tune into us. We should be able to make that work. And I am proud of the fact that our owner is not Paramount.
Hmm.
It's the American people. And we have to do a good job, and we have to be there for the American people.
A perfect place to end our conversation. Scott Simon, thank you so much. Standing ovation, folks. That was NPR's Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday. We spoke at a member event on Tuesday night at WHYY. Besides his journalism, he's written a number of books, including Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, about his daughters, Unforgettable, about his mother, My Cubs, A Love Story, and his most recent, Swing Time for Hitler, about how the Nazis used jazz as propaganda. Thanks to Yvette Sizer and our membership team for all their hard work organizing this event. The engineers for the Scott Simon interview, John Kelsey and Ben Call.
Our engineer today is Al Banks. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. For more information about The Connection, you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on the WHYY app. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Also check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows and how to sign up for our newsletter. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks so much for listening.